Recordings have started.
Thank you. Okay. Welcome to the RFP 3 call. It is 14:09 UTC. I will pass it over to Greg. We'll do the we'll do roll call based on the Adobe Connect room. Is there anyone who's only on audio? Okay, I think we're all set. Greg, over to you.
Thank you, Grace, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening, all. Sorry for the long lead time here at the beginning. In any case, we have two items of substance on the call today. The first is to take a deeper dive into the independent appeals panel, which I think is really the only part of our draft proposal framework that we have not tried to really flesh out in these RFP3 calls, as well to look at least one of the alternative proposals that has been suggested in our work, which we'll get to second, which is circulated yesterday on the list, the RFP3 list, which is I'll call it an external trust proposal. All of these terms are, you know, more meaningless as more than meaningful, more than used as signs, really, than they are as actual deeply meaningful names. But in any case, let's turn to the IAP. Tried a little bit different format for this analysis than for the prior one to try to get us to some of the points of convergence and then to the points of divergence, and then the details are second, you know, in the document, so that we, you know, don't necessarily get, you know, mucked up in dealing with a single smaller detail first. So these are points that have been pulled from our prior work, both public comment, the survey, and you know, general, hopefully a sense of the list or a sense of the room, but nonetheless, not going to take anything, you know, entirely for granted. So please feel free to put a hand up if something is identified as strong agreement, but you don't believe there is strong agreement. Obviously, if any one person or representative disagrees, that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't strong agreement, but nonetheless, want to try to be mindful here of trying to, you know, build consensus rather than assume it. So, first point, for which there seemed to be strong agreement, is that there is strong support for an independent appeals panel and that it needs to be independent, and that its decisions need to be binding, or at least it has to have the possibility of binding decisions, which may not be exactly the same thing, but I think that generally speaking, feeling is that its decisions should always be binding. Second thing that came out quite a bit is that there should be some differences in the rules or in the types of cases or the standing to bring an appeal between GTLDs and CCTLDs, and I'd like to get to that in more depth a little bit further down the page when we get to the key issues and open questions section. Third, that the grounds for an appeal should be limited to whether or not relevant policy was followed, that this shouldn't be a forum for reopening policy itself once it's been adopted, but rather for implementation of policy or, more specifically, for specific actions under implemented policies or that signify the implementation of a policy. Fourth, that GTLD registry operators should have standing to appeal delegation and redelegation decisions to which they are a party that they believe are contrary to approved GTLD policy. So it would need to be essentially their TLD that was being delegated or redelegated. Same thing with CCTLD registry operators, that they should have standing to appeal delegation and redelegation decisions to which they are a party that they believe are contrary to applicable laws and or applicable approved CCTLD policy. I would note, and we can get to this again a little further down, I don't think there's quite as strong support for this point as for the one above with GTLD operators. Third, or next is actually sixth among these dots as a whole, the CCNSO should have standing to appeal any implementation of approved policies relating to delegation or redelegation of CCTLDs that it believes is inconsistent with those policies. And here I've put in a question which I'd like to see if we can explore a little bit now as to whether this is limited to appeals from the particular application of an implemented rule. In other words, is this intended to be an appeal from a delegation or redelegation or a decision not to delegate or redelegate? Or can this be challenged, used to challenge an implementation generally? In other words, a rule that has been put in place based on policy, but which is not policy. In other words, which is implementation, but hasn't yet been actually put in place or used to in any particular delegation or redelegation. Bernie Turcotte.
Thank you, Greg. I note that Steve has said that delegation, redelegation decisions, especially for CCTLDs, are very sensitive issues, and I think the whole issue of challenging specific CCTLD delegations and redelegations as a minimum will be something that will be for the CCNSO to consider. I think we, if there are other official CCTLDs here, they can bring in their point of view. Really, it's not something for this group to get into, I don't think.
Thanks, Bernie. Are there any others from the CC community or who have a view on this, whether or not they're a part of the CC community, who'd like to come to the phone? Paul Kane. Paul, you may be on mute. Paul Kane. Paul Kane says he'll be back. Apparently some issues there, technical issues. One day we'll be able to use technology as well as we hope the rest of the world will. I see Steve in the chat as well saying that, Martin Boyle and Stefan Johnson agreeing with Steve and Paul, who say that only a few CCTLDs fall within ICANN's purview. I don't know if it's worth exploring which CCTLDs are those. Probably not, but I guess if anybody here represents those and thinks that those should be dealt with differently or not differently from those people are saying should be outside, that would be helpful. Steve Crocker, just again in the chat, it's indeed vital that there be reliable, transparent processes for making the delegation and redelegation decisions, and there needs to be a proper venue for those decisions. But it's fundamental that they are not, that these are not within the scope of the IANA function. The IANA function is to publish information that has been created, decided elsewhere. Well, I guess if we followed that line of thinking, we would end up with no appeals panel, at least no appeals of any delegations or redelegations, but really only appeals from execution issues that fall within the IANA function itself. And I don't believe that's what was intended when we looked at the independent appeals panel. I see we have a queue forming. First, I'll see if Paul Kane is back. Let's turn to Martin Boyle.
Thanks, Greg. Martin Boyle here. Yeah, I'm afraid that I do not easily see how an independent appeals panel coming in without a proper understanding of the national environment is going to be able to come in and do a binding decision. And essentially, I think my concern is it brings in a third party into a decision-making process that, you know, the third party will not have the skills and expertise to do. The important thing about the process that leads up to a delegation or redelegation is to try to get people to come to an agreement, but certainly to have a good basis for the final decision. And my understanding is that the people in the team that try to assess these produce at the end of the day a checklist that goes through various criteria and try to show how they have met those criteria. And therefore, the appeals process really does come down to being, did these people do their job in the way they're supposed to? In other words, have they gone through the various checks and documented against each of those different checks? And that if there is any doubts as to exactly what they did, in other words, they haven't explained their decision, they haven't shown the documentation, then I think there's justification for going back on that issue. But the idea of, you know, sort of a panel suddenly coming up and trying to do something that might have taken the assessment months to get through with, I think is setting them up for a fail. So I think we should be looking at the IAP role here as really quite a limited role. Was policy followed? Or rather, was the process followed? And was the documentation made available so that people can then verify that later and understand why? Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. To follow up on that, do you believe there should be a forum for challenging the delegation, redelegation decision, in essence, on its merits, as opposed to as for a failure of process at any place? Should that be at the national level, or should it be in a specialized panel?
I think one of the concerns I have with an independent appeals panel is that you'll end up going through, and if somebody doesn't win in the first case, then they come back and they appeal, and they go through it again, and then they go through it again, bringing into play quite a lot of delay on what are quite often very difficult decisions. My concern is here that you're putting somebody or some organization into that process that will not have the full understanding. Now, when it comes to who would make the appeal, I think that that appeal could be one of two things. It could be one of the parties, i.e., the two people who were contesting the two organizations that were contesting a delegation. But the decision has to be made using whatever is the relevant forum for them to resolve that. In other words, for most registries based in the country, it would be how they were responding to the needs of that country. The IAP could look at the errors of process, and there is perhaps then subsequently a role to do an ex post assessment as to whether what was coming out from the decisions was in fact correct. And then I think it loops back into that bullet with the CCNSO should have standing, where you're looking at how implementation is actually happening. Is it consistent or not? And if it's not consistent, then there perhaps is a concern with the understanding of the policy, and that needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. I see that Paul Kane has returned, so I'll turn to Paul.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I'm dialing in now. I apologize for the slight techie issues. I would just like to stand back for a second and try and simplify the process. I recognize that where a GTLD has an agreement with ICANN, it possibly needs an appeals process outside of ICANN to determine whether the ICANN board or the ICANN processes have been correctly applied. So that's almost a given, and obviously I assume that they would be correctly applied, but I understand from a GTLD perspective there is possibly a need to have an appeals mechanism. When one starts dealing with CCTLDs, the domain, pardon the pun, is significantly more complicated because there, within the CCTLD community, there is great diversity. And the thing that CCs care passionately about is making sure that the policies that the CC registry applies best serve the registrants within that CCTLD. And they do that through having a contract. The registry has a contract with the registrants, but the registry alone makes sure that the policies of the registry are applicable to the way in which it runs its operation. So if there is a dispute, the contract is already specifies a jurisdiction that is applicable to the way in which the registry functions. And therefore, the benefit of an external appeals panel outside of the jurisdiction in which the contract of the registry is based, the registry with its registrants primarily, is the jurisdiction that is most applicable. The IANA should only be recording what the incumbent registry is requiring. Namely, if a judge of competent jurisdiction says, Kane, you're no longer a CC registry manager of X, then they will also say within a time period, Kane, thou shalt make a transfer to party Y. And it would be inappropriate for any third party to interfere. Kane can subsequently go off and appeal a decision within the same jurisdiction with which it has a contract. But unless one reverts to law, then the registrants within that CCTLD could deem that the registry operator did not act to safeguard their interests, because once a transfer happens, the new registry operator may be really bad at operating registries, may decide to clean out the namespace, and so people have paid the incumbent or the previous registry operator a fee that has not been delivered. But if it's been operated in accordance with the requirements of the court of competent jurisdiction, then a proper process has been followed. So the highlight is, I recognize with GTLDs there is possibly a need for an appeals process, but for CCTLDs, because of the diversity of the community, I think it's going very complicated. And many parties do not have a relationship with ICANN, nor wish to be subject to ICANN diktat. And so it's outside of ICANN's purview anyway. So that's the point I wanted to make.
Thank you, Paul. I would take a couple of things away from that for myself or for the group. You know, one is, I think that appealing a decision of a national court, or for that matter, any you know court that's been set up under the laws of a particular jurisdiction, would seem to me to be out of scope for an appeals panel. It would be rather presumptuous for us to say, to any or all of the countries of the world that, once your legal process is exhausted, say the U.S. Supreme Court came down with a decision after, multiple appeals within the United States, and came up with a decision, unlikely though that may be, I doubt that it would be well-regarded if people said, well, okay, we have a Supreme Court decision, now we appeal it to ICANN's independent appeals panel, and they have the ability to overrule the U.S. Supreme Court. But I think that's, that's one of the issues, is that, if something takes place in a, court of competent jurisdiction in a country, I think that brings it outside the IAP.
Indeed. The point I'm trying to make is that your U.S. Supreme Court, or whatever it is not a court of competent jurisdiction to make a determination relating to a CCTLD. It might be in a competent corporate jurisdiction to rule over ICANN, but ICANN does not, should not, have any involvement in how a CC is operated.
For purposes of my hypothetical, I was actually thinking about .US. And that being the court of competent jurisdiction for a delegation.
Okay, that's fine. I'm obviously thinking about countries outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making, if the automated tools are implemented, and I think we all want to see them implemented, I don't know why it's taking so long to bring them to the fore, if those are available to the registry managers, then CCs, it's a local matter, an appeals process happens within the local jurisdiction. There does need to be some technical evaluation to make sure the new party is capable of running a registry, and that, unfortunately, in the past has not been the case where delegations or reassignments of a TLD have occurred. But that's a nice to have. The court needs to be convinced that the new party is not capable of running it. So I'm just worried that this appeals panel process is making what should be a very simple transition quite complicated, and we need to break it down into constituent parts. I'll hang up now, but I'll listen to the rest of it.
Thanks, Paul.
Cheers.
Well, let's turn to Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. I have absolutely no personal position on much of this, but I'm a little bit confused, or I'm actually a lot confused. Number one, my recollection is from Frankfurt that it was the CCTLDs present at the meeting that essentially said we need an IAP. I believe that's where the idea came from. So that's point number one. Point number two, my understanding is who decides on redelegation is beyond our remit. There have been untold discussions in the CCNSO and other locations on that. And I'm not sure why we're having that debate here. Yes, Paul Kane says the national courts in the country should decide. Other people have said we cannot allow national courts to decide because there are countries where they don't really obey any rule of law. Not on our remit. Let's get out of that. If there is something to appeal, we can have an IAP. If there's nothing that's worth appealing, then we don't need it. I think we need to go back to why we brought this component in to begin with. And if those people who brought it in no longer want it, then so be it. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. I think that, you know, certainly, you know, point well taken. Need to make sure that we have cases that people, or appeals that people would want to bring in, and the question is, you know, what is it an appeal from? I think that, again, you know, I agree to Paul, with Paul, to the extent that it's probably beyond I can remit to overrule courts of various countries. This is not a you know, a formal body in this, that's at the same level as a court. So there'd be some difficulties as a matter of law or international law with that. So, but there may also be delegation, redelegations that, you know, are not challenged in court. The question is, I think it has to be taken back a step further, which is that could a delegation or redelegation or some other action of within the IANA function, could that be challenged directly at the IANA, at the IAP, rather than at the court level? So that to my mind is the issue. Once something is in court, pretty hard to get it out of court or overrule a court, no matter how incompetent it may be. But Stefan Janssen.
Thank you. Yes, I understand that Alan is confused, so am I, but that is probably because the variety of types of CCTLDs in the world. So, yes, this is confusing, and it will always be, and as many types of TLDs as there actually are, with different terms, etc., there are also very many types of jurisdictions. Not all are Anglo-Saxon and based on court decisions, but rather on national law or not national law. So I try to introduce a difference between hard law and soft law, specifically pointing out that hard law is something different. It's really difficult to challenge hard law, but soft law is something else. So I think an appeals panel could actually give support to a local internet community, as I tried to outline in the chat. So, yes, there is a need for an appeals process, but no, it may not be that strong. And I, according to my belief, it can never challenge hard law or national law. So both is right. I'm sorry, but I think that's the complexity of the world and the CC world, at least. So it varies. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan. It seems to me this may not be well. I've got a couple more folks in the queue. Then I'll close the queue after Jonathan Martin Boyle.
Thanks, Greg. Martin Boyle here. Sorry to come back again, but I can see a role for an appeals body, but not the level of the remit for the appeals body that it has become as we've moved forwards. As I said earlier, I think there is perhaps a well, the process was not followed. This was, in fact, an arbitrary decision. This was not properly documented. I can see that as being a possibility. I would expect and actually hope that was so rare that we could almost discount it but you'd put this into place just in case it was needed. And the other one, the other area where I think appeals might be quite reasonably justified is where the operator makes a mistake and believes that they are right. So bearing in mind that this is predominantly a technical function, predominantly a clerical function, that what they have done is not right, and they're not willing to change, that there might then be a need for an appeal at that stage. Again, I would expect that to be really unlikely, and therefore, with luck, any sort of very lightweight, very administrative-based appeals process is hardly ever, if ever, used. And that's exactly where I think it should be. I think I might take a bit exception to Staffan's line in that I think the IANA functions operator getting involved in areas where there is a dispute in country is actually a slippery slope. I would be very, very concerned if an organization in California or Delaware or wherever in the U.S. Starts deciding it can make decisions on behalf of the United Kingdom. And I think that is very clearly a red line and one not to be crossed. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. I take the point that something that is definitely a process problem within the IANA functions operator role currently taking place, let's say, at the Elise Garrick and down level, where something where there's just a mistake that needs to be cleared up, and the individual registry operator and the MRT, CSC MRT, are unable to convince the IANA functions operator that they're incorrect, that there should be that this is where an appeals panel makes sense. And maybe it makes it sound a little too grand to call it an appeals panel. And I see Mary Aduma in the chat has noted also appeals for delays on delegation, redelegation process delays. I take that this is in the process of deciding about a delegation or redelegation. Typically one appeals from a final adverse decision, although, of course, there can be a kind of appeals along the way in court systems. But getting into what are called interlocutory appeals in a system like this may be way beyond. I think that goes back to Steve's distinction, which I think Martin is also consistent with, that there's a difference between the process of delegating and redelegating and then the process of actually the IANA functions themselves once a delegation or redelegation decision has been taken. I'll turn to Jonathan and then close this point with a final thought.
Thanks, Greg. I'll be very brief. I think I'm with the train of thinking, not getting involved in the CCs, which I'm less experienced or able to do, although I've heard those points. But in terms of the train of thought or the school of thought that keeps this simple, focused, and specific to the IANA function, which I think I understand to be the thought coming from Steve, from Martin, and others, that to me seems where the remit to this particular entity should be, and thereafter we should be relying on the work of the accountability group, to me. Hopefully we will hear from them very shortly, and that may assist here as well as to where they see their scope relative to our work on the IAP. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Jonathan. And my final thought on this point before we move on is that, you know, as Jonathan says, you know, being from the GNSO side, as am I, we may not have, you know, all of the experience and nuance and history to really, you know, comment with great, you know, substance on this issue. And I think it's it may be a good place for the CCTLD community, or at least for the CCTLD representatives and participants, to perhaps caucus and see if there is something that the parameters that the CCTLD community could find convergence on. Not saying that that would be the decision, the, you know, maker by itself, but clearly it would be odd for the for us to come up with an independent appeals process for CCTLDs that the CCTLD community roundly disagreed with. So might ask for you know, those who are on this call perhaps to you know, get together offline or online, but not this line, to see if there is a kind of consistent position there that we can come up with. So Jonathan, is that a new hand or an old hand? It being an old hand. Let's turn to the next point and go over to the GNSO side. The GNSO should have standing to appeal any implementation of approved policies relating to delegation or redelegation of GTLDs that it believes is inconsistent with those policies. And I've asked here, is this limited to appeals from a particular application of an implementation rule, or can this be used to challenge essentially an implementation rule itself? As policy turns into implementation, can this be used to kind of say you don't have the implementation right? And given that this is the GNSO, which is supposed to be the policy development body for GTLDs, this is a particular issue. And I'll note here separately that the Policy and Implementation Working Group, which has a draft report out for public comment right now, has proposed three lightweight processes, or lighter weight than a PDP processes, to deal with questions like this more generally, with the question of whether an implementation is diverging from the policy it purports to implement. So I'd like some thoughts here. First, you know, going back to the thought that Steve Crocker has in the chat, that none of the proposed mechanisms here should touch the redelegation or delegation processes, and that's not part of IANA. IANA, you know, is supposed to properly execute the instructions it receives from above, essentially, and that they have the issue is only whether they act on those instructions accurately and perhaps in a timely fashion as well, so that the decision, the delegation, redelegation decision itself is not open for review by the appeals panel. Is that where people think this should be, or should there be a chance to say that this GTLD should not be delegated and challenge the actual decision to delegate, either on the process by which that delegation decision was made, or even on the merits? I think the merits are probably a step too far for just about anybody, but there is the question of whether the process was followed. I see Alan Greenberg's hand is up.
A couple of points, and again, I'm not going to comment on the on how decisions should be made. Number one, in the absence of IANA, in the absence of the NTIA, doesn't our work have to effectively tell? We keep on saying that IANA needs to listen to the proper authorities. Don't we need to tell IANA who the proper authorities are, or a process by which it can determine that? Otherwise, it doesn't know who it should be listening to, and as we've heard, there are multiple opinions in some cases. So that, I think, is within our remit. I don't know how we answer it, but I think that is within our remit. There is no one else if the NTIA isn't there anymore. That's number one. Number two, on the GNSO, the redelegations we know in that case are done by ICANN based on contractual terms, and the contracts already have an independent or a binding arbitration clause in them. So I'm not sure we need yet another phase, you know, other than to complain that IANA didn't follow the instructions they got from ICANN. So we seem to be getting into a huge discussion here and sidestepping all of the really important questions. So I'm confused is no longer the word. I'm beyond that. Thank you.
But I'd like to pull you back to merely confused. I think that one of the reasons we got here is that, you know, based on polls and surveys and comments and proposal that we had, there seemed to be support for appealing implementation of approved policies relating to delegation or redelegation. And that may have been for the registry operators. We also had the idea that they could appeal the delegation or redelegation decision itself. Since these are drafts and we're trying to refine those, maybe one or both of those are incorrect and we need to rethink those. So I don't think that's necessarily avoiding big issues. I think maybe these issues are these are really gating issues of what can be appealed. And putting aside where these can be appealed, if they're outside of the IANA context, maybe that is, again, you know, something for the accountability group. And Martin Boyle says, wouldn't they appeal within the ICANN appeals process? Well, I guess there are those who feel the ICANN appeals process lacks certain things, such as the ability to make binding decisions. And are also, you know, what can be appealed there is only our only process, whether a process has been followed.
That's a new hand, Greg.
Okay, Alan, I will come back to you.
Thank you. Number one, the review process that is only about process is a review of board decisions. GTLD redelegations or changes in GTLD delegations, because I'm not sure they're really a redelegation, I believe are based on the contractual terms. And there is binding arbitration typically associated with the registry contracts, if I remember correctly. So that's number one. Number two, yes, we did have surveys on the IAP, but that's because we added it to the mix to begin with. And I'll ask the question I asked much earlier. Who asked for the IAP to begin with, and if that really was a mistake on their part, let's pull it back. Otherwise, we're trying to find a use for this thing that many people seem to claim we don't need. So, again, confusion reigns in my mind. I'm not sure why we're having this discussion, and all we can do is appeal processes. Within this context, we can appeal things that IANA does, which is relatively mechanical. I'm fine with having an appeal process that they messed up. I would like to think it's easier to correct mistakes than a formal appeal process. On the policy issue, are they implementing policy correctly? I'll point out that having standing does not necessarily mean you can do anything about it if you're also not funded and little things like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. I'm trying to recall, and I believe that this the IAP came out of our exercise in Frankfurt where we tried to identify what we believed were the functions that the NTIA currently performs, and that there was a belief that they, you know, provide a kind of the ability to make a complaint of last resort regarding significant issues with ICANN, or, you know, and particularly under the IANA contract. But I haven't gone back and looked at the notes from Frankfurt or the development of the documents. So it seems to me then that we have, I think, a lack of clarity on the types of issues that can be appealed. It seems that maybe we have some clarity or a good deal of clarity on the ability to appeal a failure or a mistake that can't be corrected through less significant processes by the IANA functions operator itself, or in its role as the IANA functions operator. Seems like we have much less clarity about whether there should be any ability to appeal delegation, redelegation decisions on any basis before those, at the step above and before the instructions are given to the IANA functions operator to take the steps that ultimately modify the route. So that's where I think we stand on this. Although I'm, you know, from the GNSO side of the house, I don't think I have, any final say on this by any stretch of the imagination. So it may be sensible, you know, again, for those involved in the GTLD policy or business to kind of caucus or talk amongst ourselves as to where we think an appeal is needed beyond the appeal from just an unsolved problem with IANA functions implementation itself. So if there is nothing further on this point, we can move on. Maybe back now we're back to the key issues and open questions, and this brings us to a variation of the question we've discussed already, so maybe we don't need to spend too much time on it. The question is, how should treatment of CCTLD appeals differ from GTLD appeals? There have been, you know, various statements made that they should be different, but in many cases how they should be different has not been really clarified. So it seems to me that at the level of the actual IANA functions operator, getting instructions right and executing on them in a timely fashion, there's no difference between a CCTLD appeal and a GTLD appeal. And then the question of what's different may be getting into areas where at least some people say there shouldn't be any appeals at all, at least on the CCNSO side. And maybe that's the difference, is that because CCNSOs, or CCTLDs rather, their relationship, to ICANN, not IANA, is different than the relationship of the GNSO, of the GTLDs to the non-IANA functions, or the functions outside of the IANA functions group itself at ICANN. So hope that hasn't confused the point, but I would appreciate any thoughts here on that point. Seem to have ground things to a halt. perhaps I will leave it with what I stated before, which is that there is that appealing from an actual error within an error within the IANA function's operation itself, should be appealable, assuming it can't get solved at any lesser level than that by either the operator involved, the registry operator involved, the CSC, or the MRT. I think, I'm not sure if it was Martin or whomever said that we should only be getting to the appeals panel very rarely on things like that, and that we will have different, above that, we may have different treatments for G's and C's. So I think maybe what we would do is kind of take these questions back to our subgroups of C's and G's and consider these so that we can try to come up with a statement and a process that makes sense. The next point, again, maybe a variation of this, and these may all be variations on the same thing, but let me know if you see anything in particular that raises a new or different question or that seems wrongheaded. Local laws, CCTLDs, and the IAP. Since delegation and redelegation of a CCTLD can be an extremely delicate international relations issue, does the CWG need to obtain knowledgeable advice on the subject of an appeals panel versus local laws from experts or from the GAC? What questions should be asked? What kind of expertise is needed? This seems to be a variation on a theme. Next point, similar although not tied only to CCTLDs, the notion of a binding appeals panel or binding appeals mechanism, which could potentially undelegate or unredelegate a TLD, is a critical issue which could have drastic consequences for the IANA functions operator and the user community. What, if anything, should the CWG do further in response to this kind of point? Do we need legal advice for this? Or is this just kind of underlying, these are maybe just kind of statements of the underlying issues that we have been discussing of, how far one can go with appeals at different levels. And then the last question, which I think goes back to something that Steve Crocker said in the chat, are delegation and redelegation decisions really IANA function decisions? And if they are not, are they just out of scope for the CWG? The corollary to this is, shouldn't the appeals function be dealt with at the level after the decision has been made, not to challenge the decision itself, but just to challenge an inaccurate application of the decision? But I think that brings us through that list of issues. Any comments on those generally? Having taken the discussion we already had earlier, I think these questions are to some extent just rehashing some of the underlying points we touched on. So, I see a discussion in the chat going back and forth and trying to figure out how to bring that up into discussion on the phone. So Paul Kane is saying, if IANA has done something wrong, then the incorrect change needs to be reversed in real time. Well, you have to bring an appeal, or it's, again, probably starting with a complaint about that that's below the appeals process, and if you can't get satisfaction at a level below an appeals panel, that you would need to kind of move along with an appeals panel. But the issue that Paul raises here, any challenge needs to happen before IANA makes the change, brings up a number of issues as to whether, you know, how long is there between the time that IANA is instructed to make a change and IANA, in fact, makes the change, and is that enough time to for a challenge to take place? Another concern that people have is that these delegations, redelegations, and other changes are time critical. So there seems to be a balancing act there. But again, I think it's helpful if we could get some from each community, the G's and the C's, a clearer sense of what types, maybe a list of things that they believe should be able to be challenged or redressed through an appeals process that, you know, sits on top of the CSC and the MRT and sits on top of at least the IANA functions as a arbitral body of last resort. So why don't we move along from that point? We've really covered the first point, I think, fairly completely, although I think we still need to come to more of a decision on that, but I think that really needs to come back from the communities on that differences between GTLDs and CCTLDs. And I think this goes back to, then we have the grounds for appeal. What we had in the draft proposal was that all decisions and actions, including deliberate inaction of the IANA functions operator that affect the root zone or root zone who is database, should be appealable. And any policy implementation actions that affect the execution of changes to the root zone file or root zone who is should also be appealable. This next one seems to be a rather broader definition since we're getting into affecting the execution of changes. Some of this depends on the interpretation. And disputes, third is disputes as to the implementation of IANA-related policies. I think each of these kind of gets to the issue of whether what we're dealing with is really an IANA functions operator problem or whether it's something above that and whether we should have this appeals panel be able to touch those types of decisions, or is it really only the execution that needs to be appealed from, execution or failure to execute? Any thoughts on that? Moving quickly through the rest of this, from the survey, there was strong support for limiting appeals to whether relevant policy was followed and also to whether established policies had been properly appealed, applied, or adhered to by the IANA functions operator. The next one's a repeat of the first one. And then a less strong agreement that all decisions and actions of the IANA functions operator should be subject to an appeal, independent appeals process. Seems to be more discomfort with that. And as for standing, as we discussed, there should on standing alone, not what can be appealed, seems to be a fairly strong agreement that registry operators should be able to appeal something, but maybe it's only actions of the ANA functions operator itself, and that the CCNSO and GNSO should each have the ability to appeal implementation of policies relating to delegations or redelegations that they believe are inconsistent with those policies. From this call, I'm not so sure. We had strong agreement on this point from the survey, but I'm not so sure we have strong agreement on this call. If there are any who disagree with this statement, it would be useful to kind of come back to hearing why. I have stunned silence. Well, Jonathan.
Greg, I guess my one concern is that the, and I'm hesitant to say this because, of course, one assumes that it is clearly understood, but it's possible the survey question wasn't understood in quite the same way, and therefore that explains the apparent difference in what you're seeing from the survey and here. That's really my immediate thought at explaining why you might see a difference.
I think that's a good thought, Jonathan. Clearly, the survey questions, were kind of in, some extent, in a vacuum, or they were, short questions. And here we are, kind of having a more in-depth discussion. And what an implementation of approved policy relating to delegation means? Does that mean challenging a delegation or redelegation? It's better to talk kind of in concrete terms. And if it means challenging a redelegation or delegation, that, should be clearly stated as the goal of this process. But, again, I think we need to go back and determine whether we really want this appeals panel to say, no, this delegation decision was incorrect. Policies that were supposed to be followed to come to a decision were not properly followed, and therefore the result is void. And then the question becomes: should at that point it be sent back to that body for a decision consistent with policy, or should the arbitral body be able to actually, in essence, reverse the decision and or make a different decision of its own based on implementing policy? It seems to me once you get to reopening delegation and redelegation decisions per se, that you're getting into some complicated and nuanced areas, and I think we have a fundamental decision to make, which is whether delegation and redelegation decisions themselves should be within the scope of this independent appeals panel for either for GTLDs or for CCTLDs, or whether they should be out of scope. I see Steve in the chat saying there should definitely be appropriate paths for reviewing, challenging, et cetera, delegation and redelegation decisions. The critical point is that these are not IANA issues and should not be framed in terms of appealing IANA decisions or IANA actions. So, I think the question is, are we comfortable putting together an appeals policy for delegation, redelegation decisions? Do we have a good model for doing so? And is that going to be apply only to GTLDs, or will it apply to CCTLDs as well, so that there could be, in essence, a choice of forum for an appeal from a CCTLD decision, as so long as that decision was not a decision that was made in a court? I see Steve as well saying it's okay for this group to consider this as long as it's framed as a separate matter from IANA decisions per se. In any case, moving through other standing points, there was also discussion of whether governments should have standing to appeal a CCTLD delegation or redelegation decision where that country's CCTLD is involved. We had 75% agree, 25% disagree, but there are a lot of no responses or just is acceptable, which is kind of okay either way. So that's not really, there was not really a major agreement on that point. So I think that's an issue that really we can't move forward on. Unless people feel strongly that we need to try to bring that issue back as to whether the governments should have a chance to appeal a decision about a CCTLD that is their country code, but it is not a government asset. Moving on to the next point, and quickly there, on the binding nature of the decision. There was strong agreement that it should be binding on the IANA functions operator, although there were some poll answers that questioned that. But by and large, they were either evenly split or, by and large, disagreed with some of the limiting language. So binding nature of the decision seems to be fairly strongly supported. Sorry about the wild scrolling here. My scroll control seems to have gone out of whack. There wasn't much disagreement on structure and process, so just to wind through it quickly, not set up in a permanent body, but that there would be either a standing list of qualified panelists assembled by ICANN or by some method, or that we would contract with an independent arbitration organization, use their procedural rules for these arbitrations, that they take place before a three-person panel, with each party choosing one panelist and the two panelists choosing the third. One of the things I think we have learned from the various objection processes that took place under the new GTLD process was that setting up the rules to be applied, not the substantive rules, but the actual kind of what's right and what's wrong, the substantive rules as opposed to the procedural rules, is actually quite difficult. And that sometimes, giving an arbitrator who may be a perfectly good arbitrator a rule that has never really been tested before and for which no clear appeals process has been designed, you may get results that seem puzzling to some. I think anybody who's ever tried to set up new laws in a country, I'm not one of those people, but I have colleagues who have, probably have the same issues, which is essentially creating something new for a judge or an arbitrator to deal with is an issue. So that's something to keep in mind in any of these arbitral processes. The better the arbitrator has, the better substantive rules and regulations it has in front of it, to decide whether they've been followed or not, the more likely we'll have a consistent set of results. I just put these in here. We don't really need to cover it. The existence of the IAP was supported by 78% of the public comment respondents. And there was a strong agreement in the poll that an appeals mechanism is needed, and that it's crucial and would be beneficial for Internet stakeholders and consumers. Also, and I think this goes back to a lot of what we've discussed, we had 100% agreement on the statement that there should be standard procedures for catching IANA process errors before resorting to an appeals process. It would be ideal if the appeals process was never used, in that if there were mistakes or errors made, they could always be resolved either between the parties or through using the, I'll call lower level resolution tools of the CSC and the MRC. I think that, that brings us to the end of this decision. So I think there are some things here that should be brought back to, you know, the relevant CNG communities to try to figure out where the limitations on appeals beyond, I think, absolute just procedure foul-ups or execution foul-ups by the IANA functions operator itself, see how far those should go. I think the who can challenge or the standing issue is not so knotty, but it's really the grounds for appeal issue that's, I still think, you know, quite knotty. So I'd encourage all of you, and probably in, not individually, but in caucuses, to try to come back to this group and to ultimately to the CWG to try to come up with a definition of the parameters for what can be appealed and what can't. With that, I'd like to turn to the other agenda item, which is what I'll call the alternative trust model. And if we could get that up on the screen, that would be great. Here it comes. That's large. Okay, now it's a good size. There are a lot of variables in this, but just to go through it, phrases a form of a question, but it's really a proposal. Could Contract Co. could or should Contract Co. take the form of a trust established under U.S. law and then registered with a state court in order to ensure that the terms of the trust will at all times in the future be met? And then that's the first kind of set of elements. Then next, that the trust would have a board of trustees, which would be incorporated in the same state where the trust is registered, and then that board would be selected from and represent the global multi-stakeholder community. The trust would, and that's kind of the second element, the trust would receive an assignment or conveyance from the U.S. government, from the NTIA, of all of the U.S. government's rights and duties included within its stewardship role over the Internet and DNS, whether they're under existing contracts with ICANN or VeriSign or otherwise. And further, that the trust would have its primary purpose and duty to ensure the continuous operation of a free, open, secure, and stable global Internet DNS, including the Internet Root Zone, by the selection of an IANA functions operator, which is presently ICANN, and Internet Root Zone maintainer, presently VeriSign, each for a term of years, subject to termination for cause, and such other terms, conditions, and covenants necessary or convenient, such as limitation of registration slash renewal fees charged by a market-dominant GTLD registry operator, not sure who that might be, in order to carry out the purpose of the trust and the duty of the trustees thereof to act at all times in the wider public interest of the global multi-stakeholder community. I think, so, boiling this down a little bit, the proposal seems to me to be to have, instead of Contract Co., a trust which would issue the IANA functions contract, and that the trust would be governed by a board of trustees, which would represent the global multi-stakeholder community, so maybe somewhat like the MRT or the Guardian under the other trust proposal, and that the trust would hold the rights and duties to act as the IANA functions operator, or to really to select the IANA functions operator at each time. So, now, and a number of things here, but I'd like any comments that we have on this generally, or any questions. You know, this was put forth initially by John Poole, who is on, I see he is in Adobe, so I don't know if, well, I see, I can let Alan and then John can speak for himself, but Alan Greenberg is the first hand.
Yeah, I want to ask a question. Perhaps Paul can, or John can answer it. I don't understand the concept of incorporating a board of trustees. Normally, a board of trustees rules over some organization, but this is not a standalone entity in its own right. So I'm not quite sure what the corporation is in relation to this board of trustees. Thank you.
John, would you like to take a stab at that?
I will answer Alan's question. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. First of all, the Board of Trustees does not need to be incorporated, but probably would choose to be incorporated to avoid personal liability to any of the trustees. If you will read the case that I've cited there, which is the New York Court of Appeals case in the America's Cup Trust, which is a trust that has existed for over 150 years that deals with international incorporated entities. Each yacht club that engages in the America's Cup has to be an entity licensed or incorporated under the nation or authority, national authority, in which they are located. If you read that case, which is very interesting because you see how a court would look at a trust document and enforce terms that require the internet to be operated in a free, open, stable, and secure method. In the America's Cup case, just to show you how international situations can be dealt with, the trustee in America's Cup is always the holder of the cup, whoever is the defender of the cup. And in the case of the America's Cup, Australia has been the trustee. When they won the America's Cup, they were the trustee of the America's Cup Trust, even though it's registered in Manhattan, New York Supreme Court. They were the trustee by the terms of the trust. New Zealand became the trustee of the America's Cup Trust when they won the trust. Trust law is very, very interesting, and we do not have time to go through it. What we do need is qualified independent counsel to advise us as to the options that are available for this, and I believe this is a very viable option because it gives assurance to all those who are watching this process that somehow the internet is going to lose the protection of being a free, open, stable, and secure system. NTIA has had an historic stewardship role. I come to the process And I want to thank all of you for your work and the opportunity to even present this. But when I come to this, I look at NTIA's announcement last March. I look at NTIA's questions and answers that they posted on their website following that announcement. What that announcement tells me, and I'm just coming to this as a domain name registrant. I'm not an ICANN insider. I have no other interest in this whole process other than from the viewpoint of a registrant. What the NTIA announcement tells me is what they want to do and what they're asking this process to do is develop a proposal to transition NTIA out of its role, period. And they go and further, and in those two documents, the announcement and the question and answers, they define what is the NTIA role. They say, number one, they are the historic steward over the DNS. They say, number two, that they are the external contractual counterparty to ICANN as the IANA functions operator. They say, three, that they are the external contractual counterparty to the root zone, independent root zone maintainer, which is VeriSign. Now, they also say they have a small procedural role, but they go on and further say, we do not have an operational role in the day-to-day functions. We enter into the contract with ICANN, we enter into the contract with VeriSign, and we have overall stewardship role to protect the Internet DNS. But we want a proposal to transition the NTIA out of its role. What this does is it doesn't do what your draft proposal proposes, and it doesn't do what the internal solution proposes. The way I look at this is that the internal solution is to abolish the role of NTIA. The draft proposal is to expand the role of NTIA. I don't think you should do either of those. I think you should replace the role that NTIA has been played. You just replace NTIA with this trust. Everything, now this whole idea, this committee can take and modify, develop however you want. The reason I put this forward is I just want it in the legal scope document. You know, you're going to independent legal counsel. I wanted it to be clear. Here's an option. Is this viable? That's all. That was the only thing I sent with my email. However, in looking over and in developing this and listening to Larry Strickling earlier in the week, I sent the same email that I sent to the mailing list. I sent to Larry Strickling a couple of days ago. And I copied Penny Pritzker with it also. I haven't heard back yet. But what I pointed out is the domain name registrants have always looked to NTIA as a protector of their interest. When the VeriSign.com contract came up, the domain name registrants, you know, they all went to the Department of Commerce. Said, you can't let them just take the .com, it's market dominant, and arbitrarily increase the renewal rates. And they came up with Amendment 32 to the VeriSign contract. That's why I think this whole process needs to be looked at holistically. You need to look at the role of NTIA. And its role, as it has defined itself, is a role in regard to ICANN. It's a role in regard to VeriSign as the root zone maintainer. And it is a role of historic stewardship. You also have a global multi-stakeholder community out there beyond the U.S. who wants some way to be able to have a play in this, that they feel left out from ICANN for one or more reasons, or they don't trust ICANN or what have you. What I want to say to the group is you've done a lot of work, but I've been following CCWG, and they have a wonderful group of people over there, and they are doing some fantastic work. I hope they come up with good solutions to everything. But the process to transition NTIA out of its role, when I look at the documents, I don't see anywhere where it says fix ICANN. You know, yes, ICANN has its issues, and ICANN should be, you know, maybe there needs to be changes. But to me, I'm looking more at, well, what is the function of NTIA, because it's external. So what brings me to the final thing is you've got a three-legged stool here that runs the Internet. ICANN, VeriSign, and NTIA in their respective roles. You take one leg out of that three-legged stool, you know, you're in a balancing act. So then we get to the stress test. And I'll be brief here. I could go long, but I'll be brief. What's the worst-case scenario if you abolish the role of NTIA? You know, assume you just take NTIA out of the picture, but the role that they're playing, the independent contractual role, you abolish that role. There is no external contractor authority. There is no external accountability with NTIA that exists. Their role has been abolished. What is the ultimate stress test, the worst-case scenario? Well, I'll give you one worst-case scenario, and that is a judgment is rendered against ICANN, whether it's under antitrust law or otherwise, for more money, multi-million dollars, that ICANN cannot pay. You have a problem, ladies and gentlemen, and you haven't even thought about it. I haven't seen that question raised anywhere. What are you going to do? And I will further say, as a registrant of both CCTLD and GTDLD, from the CCTLD perspective, they've got to be thinking of that, because they want this Internet to continue, and they don't want to hear that ICANN got hit with a judgment because of its policymaking in the GTLD area that they had nothing to do with.
Thank
so that's
you, John.
All I'll say right now. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. I'd like to answer in a slightly more lawyerly or narrow fashion. I think it was Alan's question about the incorporation of the Board of Trustees. I did a little bit of reading up on this, and it appears to me that, again, trusts are sometimes legal entities unto themselves, but more often not, and that if the trust itself is not a legal entity, then the trustee typically acts as the legal entity, as it does in the internal model, the internal trust model. ICANN is a legal entity, and the trustee there acts as the legal entity involved in the trust model, where you've got a board of trustees, and oddly, the term board of trustees is much more often used in relationship to non-trust entities, mostly universities and the like, have boards of trustees, but there's no actual trust involved. But where it is possible to have multiple trustees and a board of trustees as opposed to a single trustee, but at that point you no longer have a legal entity as a single trustee would be. So you have at that point you kind of have to incorporate the board of trustees if the entity itself doesn't qualify as a legal entity. That may be oversimplified, and as with any of these things, there may be exceptions that I'm not bringing up or not aware of. But you know, that's why typically it seems to me you incorporate a board of trustees of a trust. So that's that point. Aubrey Doria.
Thanks. This is Aubrey speaking. I think that, you know, one of the things I think you yourself mentioned it in a previous context was the whole notion of an association could be incorporated, and that the membership or the delegates to that association, and this is obviously I'm not a lawyer, could be, for example, representatives from other organizations. And I think if I understood what John was saying correctly, that's kind of the model that they had, that the yacht clubs were the ones that delegated to the board. If I misunderstood that, please correct me. And similarly, you know, both internal ICANN, the ACSO, and external to ICANN appropriate associations could be the ones that participated in such an association. So from what I understand from things that I know naively from before this and things that have been said, it seems that incorporation of an association can serve as the board of trustees of this and could follow through with the model that, you know, the trust is, you know, originally invested in ICANN, but would use notions of reassigning the trust if need be, perhaps not quite a race, but something analogous, the RFP. I spoke long ago about trust. I'm very happy to see this brought in as a proposal, and I think it offers a viable path, and I think that if the notion of association were explored, the multi-stakeholder notion of that this kind of model, in one way, providing that third leg of the stool, but it also comes closest to being a hybrid where you can still keep a lot of it attached closely to ICANN, and that's that the people making the policy that is implemented in IANA, that is deployed in IANA, are a major part of the Board of Trustees, and yet external in that it can be reassigned to a different operator other than ICANN, preserving the ICANN policymaking model while giving it, you know, some say over what happens to the trust of the function. So, as I say, I appreciate the model. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. I thought I saw John Poole's hand up, but now it's down. So we'll turn to Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. If I understood John properly, this whole thing revolves around the sanctity of the trust as enforceable by the courts. That is, the rules that are associated with the trust are enforceable, and the trustee cannot unilaterally change them. As such, I really don't see the difference between this and what was proposed as the, quote, internal trust. They would both be trusts. They would both be have the rules enforceable by a court. And I'm not sure I really follow the subtle difference between the two of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. As I would note, and I see John's hand is up, and I'll turn it over to him as well, that in the internal model, ICANN is the trustee. In this model, the trustee or the board of trustees is a global multi-stakeholder group, not ICANN. And here there is a contract, unlike under the internal model, and there's a contract that would be issued by or on behalf of the trust. ICANN, so that it would be essentially in the same role it is today as being at the contractor end of a contract to perform the IANA functions, whereas, of course, there's no contract under the internal trust model, at least the one that's being currently discussed in RFP 3B, where the right to be the to perform the IANA functions is essentially an inherent right of ICANN held in trust but an inherent right of ICANN that can be removed by the guardian for various causes. So those I think the lack of a contract and the lack of and having ICANN not serve in a trust role are two significant differences to me in this model. There may be others as well, but those two jump out at me. Alan?
Thank you. I think we have a nomenclature problem here, and I'm certainly not the expert on it. Trying to phrase it properly. I don't recall whether in the last model presented by Auda that ICANN was the trustee. I know there was terms of guardian being used, which is not a term normally used in North America, at least that I'm familiar with, which would be something akin to the MRT that we've been talking about, and that would be the body that actually enforces the trust, not ICANN as the corporation. So, I don't see any difference between the MRT-like body in the Auda model and the board of trustees here. They seem to have the same function, and as John said, he believes that the board of trustees would be incorporated just to protect them from liability, not because they're not to provide them with any different purview. So, I stand by what I said. I'm getting more and more confused, and I think we need to get some counsel who understands what they're talking about instead of us playing lawyer here. No offense to you, Greg.
Thank you, Alan. I think you may want to go back and look at the Auda proposal because it is clear there that ICANN is the trustee, and that the trustee is in charge of the day-to-day administration of the trust assets, which would be the right to perform the IANA function, and that the guardian, which is, I agree, not a common North American concept. It seems where that concept exists in the trust world, it's called a trust protector in the U.S., but basically it is a body or a person superior to the trustee that will discipline the trustee when it gets out of hand and doesn't properly administer the trust. So the guardian role is almost an appeals or higher level role. As long as the trustee is doing its job correctly, the guardian doesn't have to come into play. So again, here and let's remember that putting aside whether a trust itself is ever a legal entity, which it is sometimes, that the basic issue is that a trust is a relationship whereby somebody who is the trustee, maybe the legal holder of an asset, but holds that asset in trust for a beneficiary or beneficiaries, who in this case, could, for the sake of argument, are being defined as the global multi-stakeholder community, and that includes, I think, registrants and users, and not just registries and registrars and the like. So I think there are. I don't think it's all that unclear what's going on here, and I think the differences are significant. I don't disagree. As a matter of fact, I have to get off this call at the top of the hour to get on a call about getting legal counsel. And I don't disagree that we need it, but I think it's not to the point where we just can't understand what's put in front of us. John Poole.
Greg, thanks for your comments and answer to Alan. I could go on, but there's no sense doing that. The reason I sent my email earlier in the week, it was in the legal scope document, it read to me as it was confused as to whether we were talking about an internal trust, which is part of the internal solution, or an external solution, which this is, which takes the form of a trust. I will also add that from my own perspective, MRT, CSC, IAP could all be moved internally per Bernie Turcotte's presentation earlier in the week to RFP 3B. He had a very interesting presentation he made earlier in the week that I think everybody should look at, which was taking the CSC, MRT, and essentially, I guess, the IAP and moving it internal to ICANN. You could still do that and have this external trust, because all this does is replace the role played by NTIA. Or you can add on and keep the MRT, CSC, IAP externally, which is expanding the role of NTIA. Personally, you know, I'm not heavily invested in whether the MRT, IAP, CSC should be internal or external. The only thing I want to point out is we have an external option in this proposal where you could have the MRT, CSC, IAP all internal to ICANN, but you still have a stewardship, you still have a external accountability, you still have an external contractual counterparty to ICANN, VeriSign, and representing the global multi-stakeholder community. And to me, that is a real distinctive difference from any internal solution, which in effect abolishes that role which NTI has fulfilled up to this point. And that, to me, is a very radical step to take in looking forward, where do we go? The beautiful thing about this solution is it doesn't change any of the relationships. It just replaces NTIA with a trust of the global multi-stakeholder community. That's all it does. It doesn't change the relationships. The relationships stay the same. You just slip out NTIA and you put in the trust with the Board of Trustees, exercised by the Board of Trustees. All of the interest of NTIA, all of the contracts, they're conveyed to the global multi-stakeholder community to be held in trust by the Board of Trustees, who are governed by the terms of the trust, which can be enforced in the state court where the trust is registered. To me, that provides a lot of checks and balances and a lot of the advantages of having something replace the role of NTIA for the benefit of the global multi-stakeholder community. That's all I've got. Thanks.
Thank you, John. I very much appreciate it. Appreciate your being online to give us the benefit of your thinking behind putting together this proposal. I think it provides an interesting a counterpoint to both the internal trust proposal and the contract co-external proposal. Seeing that it's now 10:52, see if we have any last comments from the floor on this trust proposal. One comment that I have is just, I think with regard to the CSC and the MRT, we were trying to replicate functions that we saw the NTIA taking on, or at least having the ability to take on under the contract. So here again, if the contract is being issued by the trustee on behalf of the trust, there's a role. MRT and CSC, role could be taken on by the trustee itself, or the MRT and CSC could continue to exist either as committees of the Board of Trustees, if you will, or could even be working groups within ICANN, kind of along the line that that Bernie brought up, but. Any last comments on this on the floor? And then I have one more question for the group maybe to take away and think about over the weekend. Aubrey.
Yeah, thank you. I just put this in the chat, but I've also been told because there are people on the phone, one should say things. I think in this model, I think that I see a large sort of parallel between the MRT and that Board of Trustees, which I think is possibly what you just said. And I value in the CSE being something that hung under that. I think if there is an independent, you know, IAP, whether it's an independent appeals panel or an independent arbitration panel or what have you, I think that independence would possibly want to remove it from either being within ICANN. ICANN will have its own appeals mechanisms that deal with things that are within ICANN's policy purview. And for the minimal number of things that perhaps are appropriate for an IANA-based appeal, you know, for example, making mistakes that they didn't fix or taking the authority from the wrong speaker, that kind of appeal or arbitration would be best off being independent of either ICANN or this trust model. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. Good thought, good point. Good model for using for organizing the pieces here. Now it's 5 before the hour. We have one more RFP 3 call before Singapore on Monday at 2100 hours to allow our folks on the west coast of the U.S. to actually have a call that is takes place after they're supposed to wake up. I realize for other people that puts it at a more inconvenient time, but having all the calls at the same time was not sharing the pain equally enough. So some thoughts, just think about over the weekend and maybe put on the list any thoughts you have about how you'd like to use that last call. I have my own ideas, but, you know, try a little crowdsourcing on this one. You know, clearly we haven't, as we might once have hoped, brought together a new and improved transition proposal, you know, toward a second draft. We, I think, continue to converge on a number of things, but still have a number of areas of significant divergence of lack of clarity. Some of that is obviously due to the fact that we need legal counsel to, you know, maybe throw out some ideas, fix some others, and say to some to yet others, perhaps, you know, that works. But putting aside that the mechanic coming in to do that, like to, you know, have some thought about how to use that last call to kind of tighten up any thoughts we may have, or to perhaps pose questions that we need to deal with in Singapore, as we're going to have both a public Q&A and a working session, as well as being in the hallways and probably being buttonholed by many who would like to talk about their view of the IANA transition or the work of this group. So it's not necessarily going to be a free-for-all call on Monday, but open to thoughts about how some of the time on that call could be used to advance the work of this group and to prepare it for Singapore. With that, it's 10:58, and I will bring this call to a close. Operator, can you please stop the recording? I'll say goodbye to all of you. Look forward to seeing many of you in Singapore. Seeing many of you on the call on Monday, and to a continuation of our fruitful work. Thank you all, and goodbye.